Okay, great. What we want to talk about this morning really is the growing global practice of reproductive tourism. We know there is a global crisis in health access. People are crossing borders for all kinds of medical treatments for all kinds of reasons. But one of the issues that is often under the radar is crossing borders for baby making. And what are the ethical issues? What are the social justice issues? How do we balance respect for family formation, at the same time guard against exploitation? And so we want to talk this morning about what is reproductive tourism, what are some of the health and safety and public health concerns, what are some of the ethical and social justice concerns, and what kind of regulation is in place, and what are some new initiatives as well as challenges to regulating this practice globally. So I want to introduce our speakers. And to my left is Emily Galpern. Emily is the Project Director on Reproductive Health and Rights and Justice at Generations Ahead in Oakland. She works with social justice organizations to raise their awareness about health and ethical implications of genetic and reproductive technologies, to build their capacity to engage with these issues, and to promote policies that reflect a commitment to women's health, reproductive rights, health equity, human rights, and social justice. Next to her is Lisa Ikemoto. Lisa is a professor at the UC Davis School of Law. She teaches bioethics, health law, reproductive rights, law and policy, and public health law. Her scholarship is really forward-thinking, and she's a real leader in looking at gender, race, and class issues that are implicated in the development and use of new biomedical technologies, reproductive justice, and healthcare disparities. And sitting next to her is Judy Nursijan. Judy is the executive director and a founder of the Boston Women's Health Book Collective, which is known as Our Bodies, Ourselves, something that just about every woman I ever met has read. She speaks and writes frequently on a wide range of women's health concerns, including abortion, contraception, sexually transmitted infections, genetics, reproductive technologies, and she serves on the board of the National Women's Health Network. My name is Susan Fogel. Since we don't have a separate moderator, so I'll just introduce myself. I'm a public interest lawyer, and I work with nonprofit organizations on projects related to reproductive justice and health access for low-income people. In particular, I work with the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health's Office of Women's Health and with the National Health Law Program. And my background is both as a legal aid lawyer and the legal director of the California Women's Law Center. So welcome, and we're going to start with Emily Galpern.
Good morning. It's good to see everybody. I have some notes on my computer that I didn't print out, so if I forget to advance on here, please remind me. So I want to start off by talking about what is reproductive tourism. Some people may know very clearly, some people may have an idea, and some people might not know at all, and make sure that we're all on the same page about what we're talking about here. And then give an overview, and really my presentation is to provide this overview to introduce then more topics that Susan and Lisa and Judy will expand upon. And look at what is the context that reproductive tourism is developing in right now globally, some of the questions that it raises, and what is a role for us as public health professionals. So what is reproductive tourism? Basically, people who are seeking to have a genetically related child, individuals or couples, will travel to other countries for assisted reproductive technologies. So it could be traveling from the U.S. to other countries, from other countries in Europe, around the world. I mean, it's not just people going from the United States elsewhere or people going elsewhere to here, but people going all around the globe. And some of the technologies that people are seeking are IVF, in vitro fertilization, women who can't use their own eggs for IVF are seeking donor eggs. Anonymous gamete donation, where people are seeking sperm or eggs from a country where you don't have to have identity released to the child that's conceived once they reach 18. Surrogacy, PGD, which is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and that's where you screen embryos before doing in vitro fertilization to see if it has the presence or absence of certain conditions, medical conditions, or you might be screening for sex. And sex selection, whether it's using PGD or other technologies. Well, why should we care about this as public health professionals? There's a lot of reasons, and I'm just going to articulate some, that this issue really presents us as public health advocates with new health and ethical challenges. And some of these are that we need to look at how to balance the benefit to those who are seeking services to have a genetically related child with the risks to those who are providing the services. And we want to be able to examine the medical and legal issues surrounding people going to other countries or providing services and make sure that there are protections for women who are providing these services. Another challenge is securing funding to research the health implications and particularly the long-term health implications for women who are surrogates or egg donors, because we actually know very little in particular about women who are undergoing hormonally stimulated egg retrieval. What are the long-term health implications? There's been a few studies, none that are long-term enough, 20 to 30 years out after women have undergone this process, and to see how safe it is to really make sure that women are getting the full information to make a decision with full informed consent. And another ethical challenge that reproductive tourism raises are questions about the potential for exploiting women in this process and the potential for commodification of women and children. And then because it's a global, it's functioning in a global market, there's international implications for our sector in terms of health. Well, why do people engage in reproductive tourism? Why are people going around the world for this reason? It's really the same reason that people are outsourcing companies, business, et cetera. Why are people going other places rather than getting services within their own country? Three primary reasons are other countries will have significantly lower costs. So, for example, many countries don't provide insurance coverage for assisted reproductive technologies, and they're very expensive. And so if you don't have the means, or even if you have the means but would rather not spend that much money on it, and you find another country that you can afford to get to, you could end up paying a lot less. And I'll get into some examples in a few minutes. Another reason is that your home country has restrictive or prohibitive laws. So you can't use a particular technology, or you can only use it for certain reasons, but you want to go to another country to use it for the reasons that you're seeking. And then your home country may lack availability of the technology, so you may not even be able to access it there. Or the raw materials needed for assisted reproduction there may be a shortage, such as a shortage of eggs or sperm. And again, I'll get into some examples in a moment. So there was a survey conducted by Fertility and Sterility in 2004 and then updated in 2007. And it was a survey of 57 countries on assisted reproductive technologies, or ART. There's many different indicators, but these are six of them, and divided into which countries had statutes or laws. These are countries with national legislation covering the practice of ART, and there were 29 of them. Countries with guidelines only, usually provided by a national medical group with no legal enforcement, and there were 18 countries that had guidelines. And then countries that had neither legislation nor voluntary guidelines, and there were 10 of those. So some other indicators that they measured were marital status, and they looked at countries that required you to be married to use ART, required you to either be married or in a stable relationship, is how they termed it, or that there were no requirements, and that allowed single women or lesbians or gay men to use the technologies. Another indicator was embryos, was broken down into three categories, more than three possible, three max, or two is the rule. And I think it's important to note that what Fertility and Sterility reported is that the most striking finding is the great diversity in these laws and guidelines. And so that shows, because there's a patchwork of laws and they vary so much around the world, people are going from one country to the next because you're able to get around your home country's regulation. So here's some examples. Hiring a surrogate in India, for example, costs $12,000 or $10,000 to $12,000. versus $45,000 to $80,000 in the United States. That's a significant difference. It's probably more like $70,000 to $80,000 in the U.S., and it can even go up to $100,000 depending on all the various things you're doing. Now, obviously, the surrogate herself doesn't get paid that much money. I think in India, the surrogates get paid about $2,000 to $3,000. In the U.S., they get paid $25,000. But the costs also cover medical insurance for the surrogate, all of her medical costs, various different components that go along with, as well as the agency that's hooking you up with the surrogate. So that's where the difference in cost comes from. And it's just, I think, interesting to note, too, that in 2006, the cost in India for a surrogate was $5,000 to $6,000. So just in 2 years, the cost has doubled. And it's now a $445 million industry in India. And the Indian Council for Medical Research expects profits to reach $6 billion in coming years. So in India, the cost for IVF is $2,000 versus $6,000 in the UK. Excuse me. And paying an egg donor in Slovenia or Hungary would cost $3,000 compared to $4,000 to $8,000 in the UK. So these are some examples of why somebody would go to another country due to lower cost. Another reason is a shortage of supply. So in the UK, it's not established exactly why there's a shortage of eggs and sperm right now, but people's speculation is that a few years ago, the country instituted an ID release law so that when the child conceived turns 18, they can find out who their donor was. And so a lot of people are unwilling to donate. So women are traveling to Eastern Europe and paying the equivalent of, say, 2 months' wages to Eastern European women to provide their eggs. So in terms of anonymity and regulatory restrictions, as I mentioned before about donor release, Denmark is an example where people will go from other countries such as Sweden, Norway, and the Netherlands to get sperm for, could be intrauterine insemination or in vitro fertilization, because there is no requirement for identity release in Denmark. And then importantly, regulatory restrictions. There's many different regulatory restrictions, which Susan is going to get into in more detail in her talk. But just to give you an example, Germany bans embryo freezing, bans egg donation, and bans embryo screening, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So people who want to use those technologies are now traveling to the UK, to Spain, and Belgium to access them. So where are people going in general? Primarily, they're going to these countries. To the United States, to India, Canada, Spain, Greece, Czech Republic, Israel, Thailand, Eastern Europe, and Denmark. Here's an example of marketing specifically for IVF. And there's even, a website called IVF Vacation that people are not only saying, come to our country to do assisted reproduction, but come and have a vacation while you're doing it. This is the Barbados Fertility Center. Is dedicated to serving all couples, whether from the Caribbean, UK, USA, Canada, or Europe, who wish to reduce the stress associated with IVF by opting to undertake their medical procedures in a more relaxed holiday environment. And this is the picture that they show. And I think it's both because people are more likely to want to combine something like this, but also because of increased stress means it's harder to get pregnant. What they really promote is that if you go on vacation and you're more stress-free, you're more likely to become pregnant. And then there you are with our doctors on beeper 24/7. And so when you're ovulating, you call up and you get your insemination immediately, or your implantation. So what are some of the medical risks associated with reproductive tourism? Well, some of them are distinct to reproductive tourism itself, while others are related to just engaging in assisted reproduction in general, but I think are worth mentioning. So one is that the standard of care may differ in your destination country. So you may go somewhere that doesn't have as high a standard of care as your home country, and therefore you may not really receive the same high quality care that you would if you stayed home. As I mentioned before, the long-term risks of egg donation are unknown, and so if you are engaging in an egg retrieval process, you might not have the full information, and particularly with reproductive tourism, it's not clear exactly what kind of information people are getting in other countries, and so the level of informed consent may differ. In another country, it's possible that a higher number of embryos may be transferred, and your home country may have a restriction, or may require that every embryo that is created needs to be implanted. So say you go somewhere else and they decide that they're going to implant 5 embryos instead of 1 or 2, then there's a higher chance of you having multiple gestation and preterm birth. And then as public health professionals, particularly focused on reproductive issues, I think most of us in the room know that then there's increased risk for both the fetus and the mother, and a newborn who's born as a multiple or preterm. And then there's potentially there's definitely a lack of continuity of care between your destination and home country. So where you're receiving your fertility treatment, then you aren't actually going to receive the care from the same professional as when you for the person that you return home. So the continuity of care is disjointed. And then potentially weak malpractice laws, which means if something does happen, you may not have the same recourse. So I don't have a lot of time left, so I'm just going to move along. What is the context that reproductive tourism is functioning in? Well, we know that we are in a climate where globalization is only increasing, as is outsourcing, and that there's a lot of economic inequity and insecurity in all countries, whether it's there's a disparity between the host country and the destination country or within the United States itself, and that there's only increasing divide, and that the development of these technologies is not driven by the public interest but by profit. And there's this lack of international regulation means that there's a whole patchwork happening internationally, and so there's not a lot of consistency, there's not a lot of attention being paid to the people engaging in the services as much as there is to the free market. And then there's an absence of public debate and a public health research agenda related to the impacts of reproductive technologies with regard to health and social impacts. And so this is something that's really important for us to look at as public health professionals. So what are some of the questions that are raised? I think, as Susan was mentioning, and Lisa's going to talk about this more in depth, issues around economic exploitation and the commodification of women and children. Deborah Spar's book, The Baby Business, talks a lot about how babies are now bought and sold and have become commodified. And is there really a way that you can have a relationship with true agency when a U.S. couple is hiring an Indian surrogate, for example? There's a lot of debate about that within the women's health community. And then what are the health impacts on the women who are providing reproductive capacity? And how do you balance reproductive autonomy with making sure that you're securing safety for women undergoing the services? Should insurance cover ART? If so, how much? How far should it go? How many cycles? How many embryos could be implanted? How exactly will that work? And what kind of regulatory models would we seek as reproductive health rights and justice advocates who are working on public health issues? How can we ensure that any policy that happens in the United States takes into account reproductive freedom and doesn't have implications for abortion policies in negative ways that we wouldn't be able to anticipate? So just two last slides. What is our work on this issue as Generations Ahead? We're a national organization working to promote public debate and engagement with issues related to reproductive and genetic technologies with a focus on social justice principles and values. We're really trying to make this dialogue be more values-driven using a reproductive justice framework, meaning that we want to move beyond an individual autonomy and privacy frame to have a more intersectional frame. So we're looking at all the different issues that affect women's lives, economic security, job security, food, housing, race, class, and gender in general, sexual orientation, gender identity, and how all those interplay to impact women's reproductive health decisions. And we've also been engaging in dialogue with South Asian organizations and API organizations about sex selection and surrogacy in particular because of particularly the increase in the surrogacy industry in India and sex selective practices that are actually happening in many different communities, but the son preference that's taking place specific Asian countries as well as within the United States and immigrant communities. So we have plans with some of our South Asian and API allies to do webinars to engage in national discussion on these issues to ensure that there's really a voice from South Asian and API organizations, that they're really shaping the national debate on this and not being invisible. So lastly, what is our role as public health advocates? We might all have different ideas about how we can move forward here. Some suggestions are for us to create spaces for dialogue, that we're not necessarily the place that we can say this is exactly the regulation that needs to happen, but we need to all be talking about it together, that those who are most impacted need to be at the table. And we really need to look at this intersection across race and class, gender and nationality, and to ensure reproductive autonomy while working towards greater equity and safety internationally for those engaging in reproductive tourism, that we can use a reproductive justice framework and focus on human rights to make sure that the health and safety of all involved is taken into account. Thank you. So I think we're going to do a few questions after each presentation, and then we'll have more questions at the end. You know, I don't think that there is. I mean, this is more anecdotal, and if you look at things like Planet Hospital in California said last year they brought 25 couples to the UK from the, I'm sorry, to India from the US, and this year they expect to have brought 100, or that India's surrogacy industry is growing from 445 million and is expected to grow into 6 billion. So that's some indication of how fast it's growing. But because there's very little regulation, and particularly between countries, nobody really knows how much is happening. I think the only way to measure it is to see the increase in specific fertility centers in other countries, et cetera. Yeah. Yes?
It seems this isn't so much a question, just throwing it out there, but it seems that maybe there are some parallels or some similar messages we can take with the international adoption framework, and I don't know if you thought about it at all.
Yeah, I haven't looked into it too much, but we actually have a graduate student who's working with us, and particularly to looking at transnational adoption and what are the regulations and what are some of the ethical debates that are happening around it. So I think it's a really rich area for comparison. It's a good question. Thank you. I think we'll take more questions at the end.
Thank you, Emily. Our next speaker is Judy Nursi. Lisa Ikemoto. No, Judy, you're next. I'm sorry. Oh, we really are organized. Did we? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm wrong. I'm looking at an old schedule. So our next presenter is Lisa Ikemoto.
We're confused. I'm low tech. I don't have any slides. So we can just look at this. All right. My job is, I'm a bioethicist, and so my job is to identify or elaborate a little bit upon some of the ethical concerns. I'm not going to try to be comprehensive. I can't be. I think the issues are sort of emerging, and they probably vary from context to context. I'm going to flag some of the most pressing ones, and really what I'm going to try to do is even in doing that, I probably won't go so much in depth, but try to frame the issues a little bit in a slightly different way. At least in some instances, than the way that they've been framed in the media, because the media has been picking up this issue recently, and I kind of want to challenge the way it's being presented by some of the mainstream media. All right. So first, I'm going to identify some pressing ethical concerns, and then the second part, what I'm going to do is maybe discuss a few cautions that I think we should take into account as we delve into these issues. So the three sets of ethical concerns that I want to flag and discuss a little bit are, first, just the health risks, some of the health risks, and others are actually going to spend more time on that, as Emily has, than I have. Second one are some of the concerns about coercion and exploitation, the way we're using those words. I'm going to flag those issues. And then the third set of ethical issues I want to flag are what I'm calling equality concerns. I'm not convinced that's the best way to put it, but that's what I'm going to call them for today. So with respect to some of the health issues, I'm not going to go into description because Emily's flagged some of them. Judy's going to talk about them. I think Susan's going to talk about them. But I do want to acknowledge that they're there, that they are probably the most material, direct and tangible set of concerns that come out from these practices. And then the other point I want to make about them is I just ask you to think about the way that the medical and commercial practices are very closely intertwined, so much so that they're almost inseparable. So just to give you an example, in the process, for example, of egg procurement. So it's if you're probably familiar with this if you live within the U.S. Or especially if you live in California, which is one of the major markets for a lot of these services. Starts typically with the solicitation of women to provide eggs for others' use, so clearly a commercial practice right there. And then there's an agreement to transfer the eggs from the woman who's going to be the quote-unquote donor, and I'm putting the word donor in quotes because the women get paid, but we call them donors. People feel more comfortable with that. Right, and then there's the egg retrieval process, which is at least nominally a medical process. But as Emily, one of the points that Emily made is that the medical practices may be shaped by the commercial context. So the level of hormones to be given in the process of of causing the woman to produce more than one egg per month may be tied to the amount of eggs they want her to produce to make it a more profitable cycle, for example. And then you have the transfer of eggs, control, and sort of, you know, say-so over the eggs from the woman who has provided them to the clinic, the embryologist, or the couple who will use them to try to achieve a pregnancy through IVF. And then you have a transfer of money from others, maybe the couple or maybe the clinic, the center, to the woman. And then hopefully, in the best case scenario, there's follow-up care as well. And again, you know, these are all sort of part and parcel of each other. It's very difficult at this point to separate the commercial and medical practices. So I just want to flag that so you can keep that in mind. The next set of ethical concerns that I want to flag are, there's a lot of talk about coercion and exploitation. What I want to try to do is link those to some other concepts that I think are very important. Margaret Radin, who's a legal scholar and does a lot of work on property and commodification in particular, has in other contexts linked three concepts that don't use the words coercion and exploitation. She's talked about commodification, objectification, and subordination. And I think the very interesting point that she makes is that these exist on a continuum and have sort of causal linking between the other. So if you have commodification, so the sort of transformation of sort of, if you want to put in the people context, a human into a thing, because they've become more of a product or a producer, for example, right? That is the beginning of the continuum, to which she next flags as objectification. So again, sort of a different aspect of transforming a human, right, into something that we regard sort of more as a thing. We regard as something else other than fully human. And then she says that that leads naturally into subordination, right? So she sort of, her focus is sort of the way that social and political hierarchies are created in society and how those are tied to a market economy. What I want to do is suggest that coercion and exploitation also exist as part of those interlinked group of concepts, and I would put them at the front end of the continuum. So if you start with coercion, and I'm using coercion to talk about sort of the overcoming of someone's will or good judgment to cause them to make a decision that they would not otherwise make. And in the context that we're talking about now, it's through the offer of money to a woman or sometimes a man, right, to take risks that she would not otherwise take, or give up something that she would not otherwise give up, a part of her body or a baby that she would not otherwise give up. And the money offer is titrated, if you will, right, in a way to ensure that some women will make that decision because it's a way of providing for their children that they don't otherwise have, or for maintaining food and shelter for their family in ways that they might otherwise have. So that's what I mean when I talk about coercion. I think coercion and exploitation are often used interchangeably, and I want to separate out exploitation. It's linked, but it's a different idea. Exploitation is, I'm using a sense of taking advantage of, and I also want to point out that while coercion we think of as operating on an individual level, so an individual is coerced, I think exploitation often happens on a group level. So the marketing and the offer of money is aimed at particular groups of women. So if you're talking about eggs or surrogacy services, you're always aiming at young women. And you're always aiming at young women who have financial need, great financial need. So that's what I mean by exploitation. So again, I would sort of put coercion, exploitation, commodification, objectification, and subordination sort of, again, interlinked and probably existing on some sort of continuum. And I think the concern is if you start out at one end, you're just talking about, when we talk about agency, for example, which Emily flagged, and saying, well, aren't individual women free to make their own choices? The problem is that it ends up having group impacts in some context, or at least that's our fear, that it will ultimately impact the status of women. Both in their own communities and globally in some circumstances. So again, most of what I'm trying to do is reframe those issues. And then the third set of ethical concerns I want to flag are equality concerns, and I want to put them in, highlight some different aspects of them. One is thinking about the differences between, differences among individuals or couples who would like to have children using assisted reproductive technologies, and yet some of those can't afford them because this exists in a market economy. Some of those have the ability to use assisted reproductive technologies, and some of those will not. And that's true of any that's true of any kind of medical service. So in that sense, it doesn't seem any different than any other product or any other health service that's available. But the thing I want to point out is that there are norms that accompany these groups of women. It's very often true that the women who have, who are infertile, are a high percentage of women who are infertile are women who are also deemed to be too fertile as a group, right? Women who should not be mothers anyway. For example, women of color, immigrant women, have very high rates of secondary infertility. Some of those women would like to have a second child or a third child. They can't afford it to access the technology, but the typical response to them, at least in the social political context, is this population already has too many children anyway, right? We don't want them having any more children, and there's no effort made to try to address the inequality between that group and the others. So I'm pointing that out to sort of show that there are race and class implications or norms attached to these. Second type of inequality concern, and this is something that the others will talk about as well, I think, is just if you think about this in the global context, then, I mean, there are the market plays out in a way that is not surprising, given the global hierarchies, right? We think of the U.S. as powerful and probably as moral superior with respect to a lot of these issues, right? And yet Emily pointed out the fact that the U.S. is both a destination spot and a point of departure in reproductive tourism, but we tend to overlook that. And this is where I'm really concerned about the media context, is that the media's made a tendency, they're really highlighting India, like India is that place where those women do that. But India is not the only place that's doing this. It really is a global market. And the reason I think that India is attractive and easy, makes it easy and appealing for us to think about is that it's a developing country relative to the U.S. I mean, it's actually a very sophisticated economy there. But we can easily think of it as something that's happening there, something that we don't have to take primary responsibility for, right? Same for Eastern Europe, the countries in Eastern Europe. It's a different place. It's a different people. And it sort of echoes some of the concerns that I just raised before, that it's okay for those women to provide those services. One of the quotes I read in a New York Times article that focused on a couple was two men going to India, I think it was India, I can't remember which country, to access services. They interviewed one of the men who wanted to have a child, and he said he was aware of these concerns, he had thought about them carefully, and I'm sure that was very sincere. But what he had come down to was that, well, I want to do something to help these women. And I think that's a little too easy as a justification. Okay, I didn't put that very well, but I'm gonna leave that there for now to get on to the other concerns. The third thing I want to flag with respect to equality concerns is that, at least with respect to eggs right now, human eggs, there's a dual market for human eggs that exists in a global context. The other demand that's coming for human eggs is coming from human embryonic stem cell research. And there's some interesting disparities emerging in the two markets. So, for example, just to look at California right now, where there are both human embryonic stem cell research and the fertility market exists side by side, the laws have created a situation where providing eggs for the fertility market is unregulated, except by doctrines such as the doctrine of informed consent, which applies to the doctor-patient relationship, right? But the market for providing eggs, or the practice of providing eggs for human embryonic stem cell research, is regulated in California, and one of the rules says that women who provide eggs for human embryonic stem cell research can be reimbursed for reasonable expenses only. So they're receiving less, in a sense, than the women in the fertility market. You're creating sort of a two-tiered market. And it cuts different ways. And that happens in a global context as well. That's just sort of a microcosm of what's going on. All right, and then I'm just going to very quickly mention the fourth one. Emily picked up on this issue as well, and there's a fourth type of equality concern. And that has to do with the way the technologies are being marketed and the choices that people are making through them, and that's with respect to things like sex selection and the choice of sort of who are the donors? Who do you choose as your sperm donor, your egg donor? The 6'2", blonde-haired, blue-eyed male. There was a panic last year because of a scare about Jakob Creutzfeldt's disease in Northern Europe, and the FDA imposed a ban on sperm coming from the Nordic countries, which meant there was a shortage of blonde-haired, blue-eyed sperm. on the East Coast. Okay, and then a couple cautionary points very, very quickly. The first one I want to point to is informed consent, and this comes up in a number of contexts. One of the most common responses to the concerns about, well, aren't we exploiting these women, aren't we coercing these women, is that don't women have agency? If they get all the information and there's full disclosure and we're very, very careful about making sure that they have all the information about the risks and such, doesn't that take care of the problem? And I guess I want to point out two things about that. One is that one of the problems with informed consent is that it gets us focused on the individual decisions. And so you're only looking at one woman and one decision at a time. And that causes us, I think, to miss sort of what's going on in the whole pattern of decision-making going on. And the second aspect of it is I think it distracts us from the context in which the decisions are taking place, the socioeconomic and political context in which the decisions are taking place. I also think it focuses attention away from the other people who are making decisions, who participate in this economy. So the people who are choosing to use assisted reproductive technologies by traveling abroad, for example, and purchasing their services overseas, and the companies who are making a lot of money offering these services and encouraging people. So Emily mentioned one of the companies. There are now brokers out there. So they are specifically brokering services for reproductive tourism, matching up people across geographic boundaries and telling them where you should go to get these services. All right, and then the very, very last thing I'm going to mention, because I have 1 minute left, is I think I'll just stick with informed consent, is that a lot of these services, the use of informed consent in this context, it takes place in a context that's not just about reproductive tourism. The use of informed consent has become an extremely valuable tool in the growing market for human tissues and cells. So there's now also a global economy in human tissues and cells, largely because there's been a boom in translational research. So biobanking is a huge source of money right now. And when I say that informed consent is valuable, it's not valuable only because it protects the autonomy of the people who are giving up their tissues and cells for research purposes, but because it also affects the transfer of property rights. And they're using the models for the informed consent doctrines, the informed consent forms in some case, in the reproductive tourism context, are coming from the biobanking industry. So I think it's you know, the last thing I want to flag is sort of this is part of even a larger practice in the trade of human tissue, and there are some very serious concerns about sort of what it means to be human as well. And I think I'll stop there. My time's up.
Thank you.
I'm allowed to take two questions. No? All right.
Thank you. I'm going to... This is... Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm not near Sigyn, so...
Other?
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.